He's got a smile that, it seems to me, reminds me of childhood memories where everything was as fresh as the Wakefield sky. Now and then when I see his face, he takes me away to that special place. And if I stare too long, he'd probably rule out my try. Whoa, oh, oh, James Child of mine. In the words of the great Mick Morgan, send the dirty git off. Get him off the field. That were diabolical. Get him walking. If you've got any bottle, Child, you should walk. He's given a yellow card. I can't speak. You bottle-less git, Child, you dickhead. Super League referee James Child, welcome to Out of Your League.
Well done. Will's very indulgent introduction. That might be the best one yet.
James, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. I was intrigued to see what you'd do with your intro, actually, knowing that your intros are, you know, fairly famous. I don't know if that's the right word, but yeah, I was interested to see what you'd do. But being called a dickhead within the first minute, that's pretty solid. Good going, actually.
It's a solid start, that, isn't it? And James, it's only downhill from here.
Excellent.
Exactly. Look, the most important question, which of these two twats have you had the most run-ins with over your time, Wilkin or Flanagan?
God, it's definitely...
Easy. John Wilkin, without doubt.
Absolute. I've probably been the biggest pest to referees over the last 16 years, I'd say, James. Is that... I mean, I don't want to over-egg the pudding, but would that be the case? Or am I in the top 10 or top 3 or where do I rank?
You're probably in the top 10.
I
don't know. I think sometimes players who are a little bit like yourself who come and do it in a more professional manner are the ones that are more difficult to handle. The ones that will come shouting and swearing are the easy ones because you just stick a penalty on it or... hand up, walk away.
Yeah.
I've heard enough. But when you come actually and do it in an appropriate way, that actually is a little bit more difficult sometimes.
I think you're being very polite.
Well, I can imagine John using long words to try. Yeah, I can see John using long words to try and do a really good like automated argument, but then it just not falling on deaf ears.
Well, yes, something like that. I think I've had some very. I think what James is trying to say is I'm a smart ass. So I use the English language maybe to make things awkward for him. It's not one of the prouder things of my career, but I'm glad I'm in the top 10 of something because there's not a lot of me being in the top 10 of anything. So thank you, James.
You're welcome.
James, what was it like refereeing in empty stadiums last season? Does that make life easier for you as an official? With, you know, do the refs miss the crowd as much as the players do?
To be honest, it didn't really make that much difference once you got used to it. Once you were in the sort of the process of making decisions and running around on the field, it didn't really make any difference. It's just a little bit odd, I think, at the down times when, you know, a player was injured or a try had been scored and you're waiting for the conversion, that actually you'd look around and there was no one there. There was a game last year at Headingley, actually, where I was waiting for the next game to start and there was one of the director's partners, I think it was, that was making herself known. So you didn't necessarily need 18,000 in Headingley. You just needed one lady with a rather strong voice. But we still got used to it, to be honest. And, it didn't really make that much difference, but... you know, the sooner we get the fans into the stadiums, the better, because they add so much to the game.
Who was that? What names, James? Who was it?
Well, I don't know which person it was, but I know which club it was. It was Huddersfield.
Right. Well, we can work it out. It's a bit like Meghan and Harry. We're going to have to like go back to the... We're going to work it out. Who was it? James, why refereeing? Why... You know, it's a tough gig, isn't it?
Yeah. I started when I was 11 and it was just something that I did at school at lunchtime when we were playing football and, you know, on the field and stuff with my friends. And we decided that rather than arguing the toss over whether it was a goal or not, or whether it was foul or not, we'd take it in turns to referee. I think somebody had got like one of these plastic whistles out of a cracker and we decided to use that and give it a go. And I actually quite enjoyed doing it, but football really wasn't the sport that I watched. My family were involved sort of watching Dewsbury, my local team, and And then there was something in the local paper about junior referees that had qualified. And I thought, why not give it a go? I'd not really got friends that were involved in rugby league playing. So it wasn't something that I was necessarily motivated to go and do myself. I think if I'd, you know, my best mate had played rugby, I'd have probably gone down and given it a go. But I just thought maybe this is the next best thing. I can be involved in the sport, but not necessarily running around and playing.
Now, I've got a question. I mean, since you started as an 11-year-old and then you're up to doing it for a professional level for so many years, how has the scrutiny evolved from those days on amateur field to refereeing Super League? How has that changed and how has that affected you along that process?
Yeah, completely different. Obviously, when I started, you know, in the park, even now, you know, there are not many games that are recorded. And so I probably didn't watch myself back refereeing until I was probably 18, 19, 20, something like that. And so nowadays, if I go and watch one of our junior referees, I'll try and just film a little bit on my phone if I can film something that's positional related, because I think it means much more if you can watch yourself back. And until you got to a level which was probably like refereeing at the academy, that would be the first time that I would have then watch myself back and being able to review my own performance. And that's something, once you get to that level, you're expected to do week in, week out, do a detailed review and send that to your manager and then go through the coaching points from there. And clearly at Super League level, that's another level of intensity again, where you do that week in, week out, and you build on it week on week with another coach as well on the areas that you needed to improve upon and working on your strengths as well.
James, when you look at how chronological and formulaic the video referee in rugby league is, what do you make of the pantomime that is VAR in football and the criticism that referees have come in for?
Bit of an easy one for me to answer because I don't really watch other sports other than rugby league. I'm not sports mad. And so I've seen bits of the VAR system. I mean, the first thing that struck me was a referee coming to a television at the side of the pitch. I mean, I wouldn't fancy doing that at some of our grounds. I reckon I'd get pelted. So that was my first observation. I think the other thing is that people expected, or perhaps expected, that once you bring a video refereeing system in, that it's going to be perfect. And there is no perfect system. I think people have to accept in sport, mistakes will be made. And even if it's actually not a mistake, it may just be a controversial decision. It may be a decision that's not a popular decision, but actually may be correct. And so I think I heard some of the discussion the other week on Match of the Day around, well, is this a penalty or not? Well, actually, to the letter of the law, this should be a penalty based on their interpretations that they've been handing out this year. But if we sit back and look at it, you know, our football brains would tell us that this should not be a penalty. And I think that's the dilemma that you get into sometimes. You know, when you introduce a video refereeing system, it has to be more or less black and white. And there are so many shades of grey involved in officiating that that's almost impossible to achieve.
James, do you enjoy being in control? Is that part of the enjoyment of the job or not?
I think I would be lying if I said no. I think you have to enjoy an element of control. So I think it's no surprise that we've got, you know, in some of the part-time ranks, we've had referees that have been, you know, police officers or involved in law in some description, teachers, that sort of thing, where you're in a sort of a controlling role. So I think it's not all about being power mad, but I think it's about you being the one that's sort of not necessarily orchestrating, because that's pushing it too far, but you're the one that's prepared to stick your neck out and be in the middle of something and hold your hand up and make a decision, whether that's as a police officer, as a teacher, or as a lawyer or something like that. So I think it goes with the territory of the job, to be honest.
Now, how has the abuse and scrutiny from the public and the fans and clubs changed? And with that, has there been any times where you've thought refereeing might not be the vocation or the role for you? Because I see some of the abuse that referees get on social media and in person at rugby matches, and I couldn't do it. And I think that it takes a very resilient personality to do it week in, week out. And I just want to know what your thought process has been over the years on how you've been treated.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we do lose match officials to abuse, and that is a problem. And that's not just, you know, special to rugby league. It'd be special to all sports, you know, particularly at community level. And, you know, I had an instance when I was probably maybe 13, 14 with a junior team where I was just abused all the way back from the pitch back to the changing rooms by parents and officials of that team. And that was a junior team. I was a junior referee, and that was probably as close as I came as a junior to probably packing in. But, you know, something inside me and my parents' support and the support of my local referee society got me through that. And, you know, I don't want to condone what happened on that occasion, but it's incidents like that that helps you build up that resilience. You know, when you're coming off at grounds and you've got pints of beer thrown at you, it's almost water off a duck's back. You know, by the time you get to Super League level, you're so used to it. And so, it's not condoning it, but I just think you have to accept as a referee that it goes with the territory. And so, you know, certainly in my professional career, that's never really bothered me. You know, I expect to be criticised. I expect that people will disagree with decisions. Even if I've got it right, there'll probably be people that will disagree with it. So I think for me personally, it's the internal criticism that is actually tougher to take. So if your own coaches are quite negative on your performance and you actually thought you had a pretty decent game, and that's probably harder to accept. And so, you know, again, going back to your review process, it's important that we as referees try and be as honest as we can when we look at our own performance back. And, you know, there's nobody that's more disappointed that we've got something wrong than the referee themselves.
James, I don't want to make this podcast purely about your sexuality, because look, frankly, it's nobody's business but yours. However, there is obviously definitely a conversation to be had, and if you're up for it, we'd love to have it. So essentially, feel free to tell me to shut the fuck up or that's not your business at any single stage over the next few minutes. But look, you came out a long time ago, didn't you, to your friends and your family. Can you share that experience with us? And I think you tried to tell your dad originally when you'd obviously come to that decision in your own head, but you couldn't do it face to face, or there wasn't an opportunity to do it, so you had to leave a note for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been asked over the last few weeks, you know, why didn't you come out sort of 10 years ago? Well, actually, my dad didn't know 10 years ago. I'd not had that conversation with my dad until only a few years ago, and wrote that note to him. And so, you know, it's a gradual process. For some people, it's very easy, and they know, you know, perhaps when they get into their teen years, how they feel, and that's just what they are. But for me, it was a gradual process. So it wasn't really until my early 20s that I felt that I perhaps didn't feel the way I'd done in before, or, you know, I had different feelings. So it wasn't really until then. And yeah, it was a gradual process. So actually, my dad was one of the last people I told, in, you know, who were close to me. I think that's because, you know, my dad always took me to my games week in, week out as a junior referee. And not that I ever felt that he would, you know, somehow reject me, but I just found it an awkward conversation to have. That may be more a reflection on me and my dad and my family. We don't really talk about our feelings that much. And so, yeah, I tried to tell my dad over the course of a few weeks, and I'd called round and sort of made an excuse to call round and start a conversation. And I just felt too awkward. And so I thought, right, the best way for me to do it is to write him a note. I knew they were away on holiday. And then I thought, he can read that note and react however he chooses to react. And then speak to me on his own terms, and we can have a conversation about it. And it was fine. You know, in all honesty, I thought it would be fine, but I think it was just a little bit just too awkward to have that conversation with him. And, you know, we did have a conversation subsequent to that, but it's not something that we've continued to talk about. It's just, that's just life. That's part of me. It's part of who I am. And that's it.
Did you have demons regarding your sexuality when you were a kid, when you were a teenager?
Demons is probably a strong word. I think I was just uncomfortable with it. It's not how I wanted to feel. I thought life would be much more complicated being gay. You know, in terms of a coming out process, it's something that you do continually throughout your life. Every time you go to a new social situation, people will automatically assume that you're straight. And so, Yeah, it's just, it can be a little bit awkward. And I think as I was growing up, I just felt that, you know, I would be lying if I said I didn't have some feelings, but you don't know what the difference is between you growing up as a teenager, for example, and having mixed thoughts as to whether that's just actually part of growing up. And then you end up settling in on one side of the fence or the other, if you like. But I mean, my own view on it is that it's more like a spectrum, and it's not one thing or another, and you sit somewhere along that. And so, yeah, for me, it wasn't really demons as such. I think it was just something that I gradually came to terms with myself.
And when you were revealing your sexuality to friends and to people that mean things to you in your life, friends and family, of course, you were a referee from a young age. You started refereeing at 11 years old. Was anyone close to you sort of having that conversation with you saying you should consider a different career? You know, given a gay referee is not something that go hand in hand, or certainly never used to.
No, I don't think anybody ever said that, to be honest. But I think a lot of my friends, most of them aren't into sport. And so, you know, they wouldn't really know the difference between, you know, me working in sport or otherwise. And you know, they certainly didn't advise me against, you know, coming out or being who I was. So, no, if I'm honest, it wasn't something that I regularly, you know, discussed. I just felt that, certainly I have another job working for Leeds City Council as a surveyor. And the way that I chose to deal with it there was that I just said, you know, at the weekend, you know, when you had that conversation in the office, what are you doing this weekend? Well, I would just say, oh, I'm going out with such a body, and going out with such a body, and let them decide whether that person was a friend or whether that person was something more. I never, whilst I've been there, I've never had that conversation with somebody to say, oh, yeah, I am gay. It's just, I'll let you draw your own conclusion.
When you revealed your sexuality to your fellow officials, which I think was, correct me if I'm wrong, around 10 years ago, it doesn't matter, you know, let's say 10 years. What was the reaction? Was it all positive, or were there obstacles?
No one was surprised because they all knew. So it wasn't a big shock. It was just a confirmation of what they already knew, really. I think the circumstances in which it happened, it came off the back of a disciplinary case that involved homophobic abuse, and I just felt at the time that it was an appropriate junction to sort of officially tell them, really. But it was, you know, just before we start training, by the way, guys, you know, I'm gay, and that was it. Get on with the training. You know, it wasn't a sit down conversation for half an hour and let's all talk about it. It's just, all right, okay, fine. You know, and everybody was positive about it, and you know, they were pleased, I think, that I'd taken that opportunity to have that honest sort of conversation with them, really.
That's interesting you say that, because I know you've said before in the past that you'd be disappointed if someone thought you were gay when you first met them. So, you know, elaborate on that. And what was it like, you know, when you heard players, coaches, people on a match day gossiping about your sexuality when you're trying to be in the zone and, you know, top level referee?
Yeah, I mean, I cringe slightly when I hear those words back that I said in the podcast, but it's just how I feel. The reason I sort of say it is because for me, my sexuality is only just part of me. Some people are quite comfortable in their own skin to almost wear it as a badge of honour. And that's not the way I live my life, you know. So that's the only reason. And it's a reflection perhaps on the way I feel, and perhaps that I'm still not entirely 100% comfortable. I am, but I'm not enough to wear it as a badge of honour. I don't feel I need to do that. So I'm just, I am who I am, sort of thing. So, yeah, that's just for me. That's kind of how I've felt and how I've dealt with it.
Is the pressure on you to behave in a certain way? Now you're in a position of responsibility. Is the pressure on you to become a role model for other people? Do you feel that pressure?
What, following me coming out effectively to the public? I don't feel that pressure. I mean, I've had, you know, a tremendous number of positive messages from people within and outside of the sport. And so, you know, I was listening to Keegan Hurst. He was talking on a Radio Leeds documentary the other week, actually. And he was sort of saying that when he did it publicly, he didn't necessarily want to continue talking about it, but actually realised that in doing so, the messages that he'd received and the positivity that by speaking out had caused, that he felt that he was almost obligated to continue sort of talking about it. And, you know, I'm quite comfortable to carry on talking about it. It's not something that I'd want to keep talking about week in, week out, because, you know, it's just part of who I am. But, you know, I'm working at the RFL on the RFL's Inclusive and Diversity Working Group. And so as part of that, I will be doing some sort of support work to help, you know, reduce discrimination in the sport. And that's not just about, you know, gay issues or anything like that. It's a whole spectrum of discrimination in the sport, be that race, gender or sexual orientation. So, you know, for me, I'm quite happy to play my part in that. I don't really feel the pressure as such. And I've thought about doing this for a few years now, and I perhaps didn't appreciate actually how positive the reaction would be. I thought it would generally be received okay, but I didn't expect it to be received as positively as it has been. And that for me has been really reassuring, and hopefully for other people, it will be reassuring for them that actually if they have their own conversations, whether that's with their own friends and family, and is, you know, it's not as public as I've done it here, then things should be fine for them.
You mentioned there, James, the inclusivity board that you're involved with at the RFL. Do you think the game and the sport can do more towards inclusivity, and especially the LGBT community?
I think we can always do more. And that's the whole purpose of the strategy for the next 5 years. You know, we had I think the RFL had a previous campaign, and it's almost a relaunch of that, and it's a revision of the strategy. So, yeah, we can always do more. And, you know, I think Black Lives Matters, I'll be honest, last year I'd never heard of that phrase. You know, I think that raised the profile of, you know, racism within sport generally to a much higher level. And hopefully that's had a positive impact. I guess time will tell, you know, when spectators return. I haven't experienced much or heard much in terms of, you know, racist comments from the crowd. There's only been one occasion that I can recall on a professional game where I heard a racist comment, and that was from a ball boy at a game. Whereas homophobic abuse, in my opinion, is more prevalent. And by this, I don't mean somebody questioning my integrity using the word bent. You know, there's a difference between that, which I understand, and, you know, I'm being called a bender or whatever other, you know, similar words that are homophobic. You know, as soon as somebody raises that as an issue, whether that be in relation to me or somebody else, so in my instance, you know, my ability as a referee, it should be irrelevant as to whether I am gay or not. But as soon as somebody then questions your ability and links that to your sexuality, then that's when the two meet. And I think that's where sport in particular on that issue can do an awful lot of good. You know, there aren't many professional athletes in, you know, football and other competitions that have been willing to come out publicly and speak about it. And so I'm hoping that by me doing it there will be some, you know, positive ripples in the game.
Well, look, James, it's worth making people aware, isn't it? There was an incident in 2010 where you were homophobically abused by a coach. You thought you were going to be physically assaulted. I mean, tell us as much as you can about that situation. And then look, a few years later, Zach Hardacre, who was at Leeds at the time, was given a 5-match ban for calling you a fucking fag on a pitch. You know, so that moment, and he described it as a heat of the moment situation for him. What? How did you react when that happened? And were you expecting a moment like that?
No, I wasn't expecting a moment like that. And how did I react? Well, I immediately turned around, and in front of me was about three different players, so I had no idea who'd said it. And so I couldn't do anything about it at that time. But as soon as I came off the pitch and got into the dressing room, I said to my fellow officials, did you hear the comment that was made? Which they hadn't, but obviously I was in the middle of the field. But I believe it was picked up on my microphone, which probably helped in some instances because it wasn't then just my word. But actually, once I'd got out of the dressing room on my way home, I'd had lots and lots of messages from people, and it sort of went viral on social media, the little clip of what had happened. And Yeah, you know, that was difficult for me personally because I was gay, but I wasn't publicly out. And, you know, people asked me at the time, you know, is this the opportunity for you to come out and speak about it publicly? And I just didn't feel it was, to be honest. I didn't want that to be the moment. You know, if I was going to do it, I was going to do it on my own terms, not because somebody had, you know, said something inappropriate. And, you know, I've no axe to grind with Zach. I've refereed Zach on numerous occasions since, and the matter's gone as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's no grudge held there at all. And we all say things at times that we, you know, we look back on and we regret. I just think my disappointment at the time was that wasn't the message that was given. I would have preferred, in both instances, the people involved to have just said, look, I'm sorry, I got it wrong, and that's it, and we move on. That wasn't the case, and that's fine. I understand the reasons for that. You know, clubs and you want those people still involved in the game and stuff, and you know. But yeah, it was disappointed personally. But you know, those incidences have been, what, two incidents really over the course of 10, 11 years of me being involved as a full-time referee. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, there have been other incidents, not involving players or coaches, but spectators. So, you know, it would be unfair to just talk about those two incidents and almost exaggerate the point that, you know, generally speaking, players are respectful, you know, and there's no doubt about that. So, you know, I just felt that the reason I wanted to talk about it in the podcast was because they were issues that affected me personally at the time. And they were relevant, in my opinion, to my own story. And for me, probably meant that I didn't speak about it publicly much earlier because of those two incidents.
James, you've also had, you know, death threats as well. And when we say death threats, it becomes almost meaningless, just the word, because it's so commonplace. And we see it in football all the time with football officials. You know, you've had some homophobic content, some not. But you reported those to the police. What was that like receiving those, and how much did it actually play on your mind in terms of being a reality or something that someone might act on?
Yeah, I never thought that it would be acted upon, but there's a difference between thinking that and then reading it. I think the second incident, I was having a conversation on a Sunday with some friends, and she wasn't, you know, the girl that was talking to wasn't involved in rugby league that much, didn't watch the sport particularly, but we were talking about, you know, sometimes she was asking me about the abuse that I get, and I says, oh yeah, I'll just show you here, I'll show you the kind of stuff that I'll get. And I went onto my Facebook Messenger, and there was a message there that I'd not seen, from somebody that was threatening to turn up to a game with knives at the next game that I officiated at. And obviously my appointments are made public on the internet, and they're there for anybody to see. And so that could have been something that could have happened. Now, you know, when the police investigated it, that person was spoken to, and they were genuinely horrified and entirely apologetic. And it was said in the heat of the moment. I in fact, actually wasn't even the referee on that game. I was the video referee, but made a decision at the end of the game that decided the outcome of that game. And, you know, you can argue whether you think it's right or wrong, but in our view, the decision was correct. But like I said earlier, it doesn't really matter whether the decision's right or wrong. It's what somebody else thinks. If somebody else thinks it's wrong, then you're the one that's going to be to blame for it. And that's the rationale for the comments being made. You know, but did I actually think I would be stabbed and killed? No. But you never really know, do you? You don't know the mindset that somebody else is in. You don't know whether they're suffering from mental illness or whatever. And so I just felt that those two occasions were the occasions that should be reported to the police.
That concept of saying it was said in the heat of the moment as maybe a justification for understanding that people get angry about things and communicate poorly at those times, I think it's fucking outrageous that somebody would spend even... You have to type that and press send. So social media and the way in which we communicate now is faceless, absolute, nameless trolling and bullying of people. And Do you know why I feel like James has got to the top of his profession? Because his self-esteem is strong enough to deal with that. He wouldn't have got to be a top referee in rugby league if your self-esteem can't take that constant barrage of abuse and criticism. You simply just do not make it to the top of your profession. And I think it's more of a statement than anything, is that James's self-esteem and his ability to absorb negativity and criticism is one of the reasons why he's exceptionally good at his job. And for these people who are out there, and there'll be somebody who's tapping a keyboard now to somebody, you're fishing in the wrong pond. You know, these guys or people, whoever they are, coming at people like James Childs to get a reaction, you're just not going to get it, because the guy's dealt with worse and dealt with it all a million times. So I think society as a whole has to have a word with itself about what's the right way to communicate with other people. And I've seen it as a player. I know Mark's definitely seen it. Will, I assume you've been on the wrong end of criticism as well, publicly. And James, you certainly have. So we've all seen the worst of that, haven't we?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's not just peculiar to referees. It's not just peculiar to rugby league. Or it's just a society issue. And, you know, actually, people on Facebook, it's not faceless. They attach their name to it. They attach their face to it. Not always, but generally. And actually, sometimes that's what I find even more surprising, that people are actually prepared to put their name to it, go to the extent to find me on Facebook, to send me a message. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't seek out those messages. Most of the time, I don't even open them. So if you want to do that in the future, you're just wasting your time. But yeah, it's a society issue, and I don't know how we as a society change that. I know I was listening today to, I think, the broadcast minister on the Jeremy Vine show, and he was talking about some government policy or law that we were trying to introduce to combat abuse on social media platforms and get the platforms to actually do something about it.
Keegan Hurst, who you mentioned, James, as well, is the only, certainly one, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only high-profile rugby league player to come out. I know Gareth Thomas came out, I think, when he was playing at Crusaders, but, you know, we associate Gareth more with rugby union. What is holding players back and others within the game to, you know, like, you seem to have made this transition of, you know, coming out as gay seamlessly?
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that, I guess. You know, I don't socialise with players outside of, you know, game day scenarios. So I don't necessarily have the answer to that. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that the stats will bear out that, you know, 10% of professional players are gay, because, you know, it's just that, you know, as sort of Keegan said the other day, you know, people will potentially be put off earlier in life from playing a sport like rugby league because they cannot see representation. And that's why me speaking about it publicly, that's why Keegan speaking about it publicly, might actually encourage other young people to play the game that may be gay, because actually they recognise that this is an inclusive sport. So there will be, I think, in my opinion, there will have been players perhaps in youth and junior that may have, as they've grown up, felt, actually, I'm gay, but this is not a situation or an environment that I feel comfortable in, and they may have withdrawn from playing. So I suspect that may be a part in it, but I don't have the answer to that.
James, why did you come out publicly then? You know, because for me, your sexuality is largely irrelevant, you know, in many senses in my life. It's not something I've wondered about or thought about in detail. And it just interests me as why now come out and be publicly, you know, publicly like this.
It got to the point for me where I was going to games. Again, last year wouldn't count for that because there weren't fans in the stadiums for most of the year. But I was going to games on a fairly regular basis and receiving homophobic abuse. And I was getting, to be honest, sick to the back teeth of it. We don't have a voice, particularly as a referee, and that's right. You know, we're there to do a job and that's it, you know. But I just felt that it was probably a stronger position and a stronger stance for me to take to actually speak about it publicly and just say, look, I don't have a problem with it. You know, I've lived my life open. It's there on social media. My Instagram is open. You know, I just put photographs on there. People draw their own conclusions, whatever. I'm not bothered. But actually, what I am bothered about is, you choosing, if you wish to abuse me for being gay. You know, by all means, criticize me, but don't use homophobic language. And it might not be something that is just affecting me. It might be affecting the people around you, that actually other spectators around you may be gay and may be feel uncomfortable about that. And so that's really where I got to, that actually I got to the point where I was a little bit cheesed off with it. And I was prepared to hold my hand up and say, well, not hold my hand up, that's probably the wrong phrase, but I think you understand what I'm saying. It's just speak about it publicly and just say, look, this is not a covert issue. I'm quite comfortable in who I am. And if you choose to continue doing it, then you're doing it in the full knowledge that I am gay. It's not some sort of inside secret or whatever.
And on that, you know, being a new season coming up, because obviously this is the off season, and I think that's, you've said, James, haven't you, you wanted to do it during an off season. So it's not about, you know, so it doesn't get involved with what your main job is. But with it being a new season coming up, inevitably, things might be different. What are you expecting?
In relation to how this may play out, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, the messages that I've received from people and the positivity that's been brought about from it, I'm pretty hopeful that the abuse that I have had in the past will actually reduce. And that was one of my parents' concerns as to the reason why I didn't do it a few years ago. You know, that they felt that the abuse would only be worse as a result of it. I actually think it will be reduced. You know, and I think people will be brave enough actually to call it out if they hear it as well. And so, no, I'm looking forward to the new season and looking forward to getting the fans back in there and, it just, you know, life getting on as normal, really.
Does it feel like a sense of relief, a weight off your shoulder?
Yeah.
Sorry, say that again.
Go on, Mark.
Go on, Will, you go. Oh, you go, Will.
We asked the same question, didn't we? And it's a good question. You know, does it feel like a weight off the shoulder, a relief? I know you've been, to friends and family, comfortable within your own sexuality and within your own body over the last 10, 12 years, but to publicly talk about it feel like a relief?
To some extent, yeah. I think, as you've said, you know, the biggest hurdles for me were family and friends and things like that. And coming to terms with it yourself. And so once you become comfortable in who you are, then it doesn't then matter who you speak to about it. And so, yeah, to some extent, you know, I am relieved now that I've done it. And, you know, I'm absolutely delighted in the response that I've had.
In that, I find that fascinating, right? Because in your professional life or your working life, like, you feel a sense of relief for your, you know, something that's deeply part of you is out there now. And I don't necessarily feel like you were hiding it or trying to hide it or living a lie. Do you know what I'm saying? So I find it strange, like, because if I came out and said, right, I'm heterosexual, I'm a heterosexual white man, I would feel no relief in that whatsoever. So why the hell do we have this thing where it's like, you should feel relieved for this part of you being out in the public domain? There's no rationale behind that being, there's no logic behind it whatsoever. So we're saying, right, James should be relieved because now everyone knows that he's gay. What the hell are we talking about?
But we know how society, we know how society reacts, Wilco. That's why we're asking that question.
Exactly. Absolutely, Will. And it's right to ask the question. I'm not criticizing the question at all. I was just thinking about that when you asked the question. And when you and Mark asked the question at exactly the same time, I was thinking, what would that feel like if that was me? So if I walked into work, into the business that me and Mark have got, and I said, guys, I'm a heterosexual guy, you know, I like women. Like, would I feel relieved that they knew that? Or there's an assumption, if I was single and they didn't know, should there be any relief that they know that? And the answer is no. And I just want there to be a position where James maybe doesn't feel that the need, or we're not asking him to feel that relief, if I'm making sense. I don't know if I've gone too far down.
No, you're making complete sense. I think it's difficult. It's difficult to understand, you know, as a society, the society norms, the stats say that 9 out of 10 people are straight. So vast majority of people, you know, it's something that it's difficult to put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. You know, I can only speak from personal experience. So, you know, you're absolutely right. I shouldn't necessarily feel relieved because it shouldn't be an issue. You know, me speaking about it publicly, this shouldn't be an issue. It shouldn't be a story. I get that point of view. I get why people will say that. Well, it's irrelevant. Of course, it is irrelevant. But my point earlier on was when somebody abuses me for being gay and then relates it to my job and suggests that it's because I'm gay that I may be crap or whatever, then that's suddenly then the two become linked. But you're absolutely right. We want to get to a stage where actually it does become irrelevant, you know. But like my partner and I, we were due to get married this year, and it's just simple things like, you know, you're filling an online form, you know, for your wedding photographer, and it's, you know, it's bride and it's groom. Well, you know, how long has gay marriage been legalized? You know what I mean? And I sort of said, well, I was slightly disappointed when I filled in the form that it was designed for a heterosexual couple. You can't be the only gay couple that you've done photographs for. You know what I mean? And so, and therefore you are facing, I'm not saying you're facing prejudice, but society, because the vast majority of society is geared around straight people, then that's what people, you know, think. They think through that those glasses, if you like.
And those kinds of prejudices, those kinds of prejudices flash are subconscious, aren't they? You know, the person who's made that form online, it's not about malice towards your sexuality. They're just viewing the world how they see it, aren't they? And that when you're in a smaller minority, you know, that's the difficult things. Those maybe Chinese paper cuts of a thousand things over time that just make you feel like what you're doing isn't normal. And you know, I've read a lot about, you know, the Black Lives Matter and sort of subconscious racism that we're all part of, or subconscious homophobia, and I've taken time to read it, and it's those subliminal messages that are behind the scenes that are sometimes most damaging.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're absolutely right. You know, the wedding photographer didn't mean anything by that, but it just shows that's how, you know, as a straight person, that's how you see the world. And you can't necessarily see it from somebody else's point of view. And he did say, you know, we will make sure we change that form. And to be fair, when we postponed the wedding because of COVID, he had changed the form. So I was pleased about that.
History tells us that, like James said, the majority of people are heterosexual rather than homosexual. I think it's a bit of a journey of breaking down barriers. And I think as more time goes on, these obstacles or these issues that the parts of society that don't have as much freedom or doesn't have as many things going their way as possible is happening. But it's a lot too slowly. And like James alluded to earlier with participation in sport and having those role models like Keegan and like James breaking down those barriers, it will increase participation and then open more doors for those people in the future.
But the issue we've got there is that if it is 1 in 10 people are gay, that, right, let's say that will always be a minority, you know, it amongst the public sphere, and therefore the subconscious biases what we all have will to some extent always be there. I believe that we're in a good place in terms of acknowledgement, talking about these things. But I also think that just statistics show that when you're in a minority, you might not be considered as much as you should be by the majority. And you know, this is, you know, we're talking about big sort of statistical things, but that, you know, that'll always be a challenge. But all we can do is try and understand and listen and make changes. What, there's nothing else we can do, is there?
No, political correctness is not, you know, it's not a favourite subject of, you know, of most people. It's not one of mine either. And that's not necessarily what I'm advocating, that we should be entirely PC. You know, I can take banter about my sexuality as much as anybody else can. So, you know, I'm not talking about that. I think it's just raising awareness, I think, of issues. That's all. And I think offering a representation for people who may have felt that actually this sport, for example, is not for them because they happen to be gay, that actually it can be for them. You know, or if they're, you know, if they're female, for example, that it's not for them. Well, it actually is for them, or, you know, whatever their background is, we want to make this an inclusive sport for anybody.
James, I know this isn't, you know, some sort of soapbox for you to be a gay icon and a gay role model, but what would you say to anyone who, and I'm not talking about people who haven't yet come out to their family and friends, because that's a very personal thing, but an experience that you perhaps can share of people who have reservations about coming out to people at work, perhaps in a high profile job like you?
Yeah, a friend of mine gave me a book, actually. I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically about people coming out at work and actually the benefit that that can bring you, just about being your sort of true self. And, you know, I've listened to some podcasts where they've sort of said that some athletes have sort of said that they felt that it gave them that extra 1% or whatever, that the fact that they've been able to then speak about it publicly, whether they were sort of hiding something or not being true to themselves. So it might be that, you know, it can improve your performance at work by being more comfortable about who you are. But as I said earlier on, in my office sort of role, if you like, my other occupation, I just dealt with it. I didn't do a big coming out story. I just told people that I was going to see somebody at the weekend and they would draw their own conclusion. Do you know what I mean? So it doesn't have to be a big proclamation. It hasn't been a big proclamation in my life today. And the only reason it sort of come to this, in my opinion, is because of the abuse that I've received, and I was prepared to make a stand about it. And hopefully that will change for the positive. So the way I would advocate it is just be who you are, just live your life normally, and people will accept you for it. Don't make a big deal out of it.
Right, listen, we get a whole load of questions in from the out of your league faithful, James, some serious, some so not. And remember, you guys listening can get your questions in on Twitter every week, out of your RL on social media. This one from Wire Knox, James, he says, what can be done to stop the exodus of experienced referees leaving the sport, which is one of his questions? And should all coaches, Super League and semi-pro clubs players be made to take up the referee's course?
The exodus, there's a whole host of different reasons why people have left. And there's probably too numerous to sort of go into that level of detail. I think, you know, refereeing as an occupation is such a demanding job. You know, I'm sure it is as a player. You know, but just taking as a small example, for example, we don't know what games we will be doing week to week. So we will find out on a Monday evening, Tuesday morning, where we will be that weekend. And so if you're a part-time match official and you're working full-time Monday to Friday, you might find out that actually Thursday night you've got a game, and then Friday night you've got a game. Or, you know, it could be your Saturday and Sunday that's taken up by officiating as well as your full-time job. So there are so many different reasons, and, you know, abuse may be one part of that. You know, internal criticism may be another part of that. It may be a change in somebody's life circumstances. What was the other part to his question, did you say?
The second part was, yeah, should all coaches, Super League and semi-pro clubs players be made to take up the ref's course?
I'm not sure whether they should be made to take it up, but I know some clubs have done that voluntarily in the past. And I think it would only serve to help people. You know, one of the things I never quite understand as a referee, if you give a penalty within the last 10 metres on the goal line, teams often want to kick the ball back into touch. But actually, you can walk that ball back as far as you want. So you can walk the ball back 20 metres and the defensive team has to stay on the goal line. And so actually, you get a bigger advantage by just walking the ball back.
I knew that.
What the hell? I didn't know that. I've been doing a little shin roller into touch for 16 years.
And this is it. So it might just be actually something as simple as that. Some little quirk that you may find out by doing a course. It might never lead to somebody taking up the whistle, but, you know, it would be great if we could get more players refereeing. And, you know, I thought tonight I would give the opportunity for John to join us and take up the whistle and give it a go.
Not a chance. Hey, James. You know, you said you had a week at work. Did you ever take a stinking work week into a game? Did you ever go, right, I've had a bad week at work, and take that mood into a game? And I want the answer to be yes, but I'm not worried if it's no. Oh, he's a liar.
No, to be honest, for me, particularly as a part-time match official, It was like a paid hobby to do your rugby at the weekends or on a Friday night, you know, and go and run a line when I was working full time during the week. It was something that I looked forward to doing. And so if I'd had a crap week at work, it was such a change of environment from sat behind a desk, you know, behind a computer to then go and run around the field and make decisions. I just, you know, I used to enjoy doing that. So I would never have done that. I know some referees have, you know, if they've had a fight with the wife at home, then they may have taken that out onto the field. But then again, you might have been like that, John, the way you spoke to some of the referees at some times.
Absolutely. I'll always, is it Tony Archer, James? The touch Tony Martin, the older guy.
Tony Martin.
Sorry. Yeah. I remember I must have said something horrendous to him because he never forgave me. Like we were at the Man of Steel dinner one year and he'd had a bit to drink at Tony and fair play to him, he'd had a tough year or whatever. And he came up to me and he said, "I've seen your face on the Respect the Referee posters." He said, "What a fucking joke." I was like, oh, I didn't actually know what I said. I must have said something bad. But I've said a few dodgy things, but massively respect. Do you know what? I've not had this opportunity really to say, I do actually massively respect what you guys do. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. Mm.
I couldn't either.
Self-esteem being that strong. Mate, I think you're in a very small percentage of people in the world who could absorb that negativity and deal with it. So, you know, I might have given you a hard job over a number of years, but respect massively what you do, mate.
Let's rattle through a few more of these questions that you guys have been sending in. This one from your alter ego, James Wilde, who says, it does seem that big games are refereed differently than regular season games in terms of letting it flow. Is that a conscious thing from a referee to create a better spectacle for the crowd or for the TV?
When you get a big game, you tend to get two teams that are on form, that are playing well. They actually just want to get on with the game. And I think that's the big part of it. We as referees, if we can just sit back and let the game flow, that's what we want to do. That's our dream game. You know, we don't want to be jumping in with the whistle all the time. So, you know, to some extent, yeah, there is a spectacle. And the last thing we want to do is be blowing the pee out the whistle. So we will want to try and take a backward step. But if the game requires us to step in and make decisions, we'll do it, no matter what the occasion will be. You know, so I think the biggest influence on that are the teams. The teams want to get on and play and we're able to sort of let them do that.
Zach says, we always hear players' best teammates. What about referees? Who's the best referee that you've worked with, James?
I always really enjoyed working with Ashley Klein when he was over here, you know, touch judging with him. And when I was coming through the ranks, I always felt that, you know, the way they worked it then, and they still work it now, you know, as a sort of a junior referee, you know, less experienced referee, they'd put you with a more experienced, so you touch judge for the more experienced referee. And as part of that, you're learning from them. And I always used to enjoy working with Ashley and, you know, still do.
Carsten says, he's got two questions. A serious one, how do you handle the abuse that you get from the fans behind the in-goal area? And the joke one, how do you handle the attention that Hollywood Thaler gets off the field?
Well, in some of our Microsoft Teams meetings, one of our referees, I won't name him, Ben introduced a new hairstyle on round one of the restart, and I don't think it went down that well publicly, so he soon got rid of it the week after, but it keeps making a reappearance sometimes in our meetings. But no, I mean, you know, in terms of the abuse behind the sticks, I like the ones when they're funny, you know, make me laugh if you're going to do it. Be original. You know, it's just moronic ones that you've heard week in, week out. They don't pass muster. So if you're going to do it, let's make it funny.
That sounds like a challenge.
Question, Will.
Go on. You should have tweeted questions. It in, Mark, so, last week, but go on.
Yeah, I know. I do this every week. So before we went on air, we had a little chat with James, and the referees have just completed, well, just at the end of their pre-season for this coming season. So I want to know who, out of all the referees, is the worst trainer, and who's probably not quite as up to scratch in terms of the fitness as the rest of you?
The worst trainer? Well, I would say if we won prizes for talking, then Ben would win that prize. There's no doubt about that. Okay. Ben loves a talk in between, you know, weight sets and stuff like that, but you know, he's got, to be fair to Ben, he's got a big heart in him. So when you're doing a fitness test or something like that, and you've got to dig in, Ben's really good at digging in and getting through, you know, the pain barrier. But he does like a good chat in between the weight sets.
So we'll look out this season. When he's getting a bit tired, he'll give a few penalties away, have a few chats to a few players, and then let the game flow again.
Well, we can't do that now. We've got to give set restarts. There aren't as many breaks. We don't have the scrums. Yeah. It's all handovers.
That's it.
Yeah, the game's quicker for us as well, don't forget. And we can't get subbed off. We've got to do the 80 minutes.
That's why John and I retired.
Absolutely, yeah. I was trying to get subbed off for Ben Thaler. He wasn't coming on.
Kieran says, favourite game that you've refereed, James?
Oh, I've been involved in so many great games, I must admit. But as a referee, probably the semi-final, Castleford against St Helens, the week before they did the grand final in 17. I know, John, sorry. No. Sorry to bring that up.
No way. How dare you?
It was good. For John and St Helens, it was, you know, the wrong result, obviously. But, you know, for the game, it was the first game that ever went to Golden Point as a playoff game. And it just about had everything. You know, it's a tightly packed crowd in at Castleford. So the atmosphere is always tremendous. And it went to Golden Point. So it kind of had everything. And whoever won went to the grand final. So I'd have to say that game.
On that, Ryan Morgan, St Helens right centre, did the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen anybody do. And he cost us that game. We were going to the grand final. And it was that penalty, James, wasn't it, that changed everything.
It was, but I mean, you used the phrase there that cost us. And, if I was going to defend Ryan, as I would do, because people will point their finger to referees and say that decision cost us, there was more than that one event in the game. It's just that one event came in the last few seconds of the game, and that's the one that took it to Golden Point. And so that's the one incident that everybody will talk about. And nobody will talk about the knock-on, perhaps in the first minute or 2 minute or whatever. So,
what a great teammate John Wilkin is. Blame and his friend.
Yeah.
His true colours have come out.
No, yeah.
A couple more, here we go. This one from
typical of what he is.
This one from Mark Thomas, who gets a good question. Anyone listening, who what advice would you give for anyone who wants to become a referee? And I'll add on top of that, you know, when is too late age-wise? Do you have to have done it from 11 like you, or can you take it up in your 30s?
It's never too late to start. And over the last month or so, we've been doing online courses. And that's had its own advantages because the numbers of people doing those courses have gone through the roof. I think there was one at the weekend that Huddersfield and the Bradford Society did. I think they had over 50 people on it. And I'm not saying that all those 50 people will go on to referee. For some people, it may just be their education. But, you know, the biggest thing I would say is just give it a go. You know, my dad used to take me to all my games and he used to play himself amateur. And there was one day where he's been involved in our local referee society for years, ever since I've been there. And some junior referees didn't turn up to one of these gala days on a Sunday. And so he said, I'll give it a go. It can't be that hard. I've watched James, you know, do it. And he was standing in the attacking line, not the defending line. He couldn't keep his tackle count. You know, people will be amazed, actually. They think they can do it. You know, my invitation would be, as the Connolly brothers found out, they were sort of people that would stand on the terraces at Wigan shouting at the refs. And somebody turned around to them and said, why don't you give it a go? And they did. And, you know, and they made a good fist of it, being involved in Super League themselves. So that's the biggest thing I would say, is just give it a go. And I think you'd be surprised, actually, how much you would enjoy it.
We have a special bunch of listeners. This one from Josh. If you had to choose between fingers as long as your legs or legs as long as your fingers, which one would you pick?
Fingers as long as my legs. I'm trying to work out how that one would work.
Fingers as long as your legs, surely. You'd just be like able to grab.
Talking people all the time.
Yeah.
Or legs as long as your fingers.
Yeah, definitely.
No, that'd be horrendous.
No, definitely the longer fingers.
And last one, DJ Neil Scotland, who I think we've got some work from his first tweet of this new series. What current rule would you change, James?
Current rule? Well, I wouldn't change any of them, to be honest, other than because we keep changing them every year. Boom. We change the rules. I would just have one set of rules for the game of rugby league, no matter where you play it. And that's as simple as that. And we keep tinkering with the rules every year. And as soon as we change to copy the NRL, the NRL changed something else. And, you know, when we come and do international tournaments, we have to have meetings to decide on the laws and the interpretations. So let's just have one set of laws.
Well, I was used to be on the Rules and Laws Committee, and a very senior ranking person at the RFL was trying to get there to be a bonus point if you chipped over. That was the level of conversation we were having. If you chip over and get it, chip over and regather, you get a bonus point. I was like, no. Just don't do it. Can you imagine though? Just everybody be like chipping over 25 times a game. Anyway, that's the level of conversation, James, just so you know.
I know that. I've heard of it. And, you know, in fairness, it's not the referees that change the laws. The Laws Committee is made up of a whole wide range of people from, you know, the RFL's doctor to Super League players to Super League coaches. But you've got also sort of got a club chairman and things like that in there. So it's a body that makes those decisions. It's not the referees. We just go out and operate them.
Did you have any good ideas, John? No.
No, don't think so. No. James, we're going to finish up with a quick fire 15. So 15 questions where I need a rapid response. Anything you do say will not be used against you in a court of law and you will not be judged. Mr. Child, do you understand?
I understand.
Okay, here we go. First up, Team Megan or Team Queen?
Team Queen, obviously.
Who'd win in a fight, you or Robert Elston?
Oh, I'd have to go me, wouldn't I? I've got to back myself.
Who'd win in a fight, Brian Barwick or Nigel Wood? Both are naked.
Well, just before you added the last bit, I was going to say that would be an interesting one to watch, but maybe not now you said that.
No, I'm not going to sleep. Jeez.
I reckon.
I need an answer, James.
I reckon it's Nigel.
Nigel, would you cut off your little toe to referee 7 back-to-back grand finals?
I don't need a little toe, do I? Yeah, sure.
Favourite cheese?
Cheese. I'm boring with cheese. Cheddar.
Celebrity crush?
Celebrity crush. Now, should I say John Wilkin or not?
Watch him squirm.
I'll take that as your first answer.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
if you could send off Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock or Nicola Sturgeon, who gets the red card?
That's a toss-up between Boris and Hancock, I reckon. But given he's the guy at the top, it's got to be Boris, hasn't it?
What's the capital of Peru, James?
Capital of Peru? Lima.
Lima.
Correct. What's your middle name?
Christopher.
Godfather or Star Wars?
I've not watched either, but if I was to watch them, I'd watch Godfather. I'm not into sci-fi.
Who would you bring back to life? Elvis or Mother Teresa?
I reckon Elvis would be more fun, for sure. Maybe you could do the grand final in the entertainment before the match.
If you weren't a referee, what would you be doing?
I'd be a surveyor because that's what I do part-time. So, yeah, it's a bit of a boring answer.
Who would you rather be for a day, John Wilkin or Mark Flanagan?
I'd have to say Mark Flanagan, obviously. Because, you know, it looks like Mark can afford to put his heating on and John can't with his hat on.
Who would play you in the James Child movie?
Oh God, James Bond? No idea.
And finally, Wigan and St Helens are both on fire. Everyone is going to die. You have the chance to extinguish the flames at one town. Who do you save?
Will, I am not even going there. No way. Can I ask the video ref on that? Can I ask the video ref on that?
He said Wigan.
The only problem is I've got to nominate try or no try. So, yeah, no, I'll pass on that one.
We'll save that one for the Good Friday Derby, eh? Listen, James, it's been a real pleasure having you on, mate. And I know you know, hopefully it wasn't all just about the sexuality, and I know you were keen not to just talk about that because, as you said, it's a part of you, but it's not your identity. And it's been great to chat, mate. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, likewise, thank you. Thanks for speaking to us.
Yeah, cheers, James.
Thanks, Paul.
And remember, everyone, thank you very much for listening, but the big guest will keep on coming. We'll have a new episode for you every week available to download from wherever you get your podcasts. You can watch all the episodes as well for years gone by on YouTube. And don't forget to give us a follow on Twitter @OutOfYourRL. Be seeing you.